Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here at Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. This week, Ken is gearing up for PAX, so he wouldn't be able to make it, but I have a special guest nonetheless. From Conifer Games, he is the lead designer behind the upcoming strategy game At the Gates, John Schaefer.
Thanks, Josh. It's nice to be on.
Yep, it's great to talk to you again. How was everything at GDC?
It was good. As I was telling you a little bit before we started, I didn't actually attend the show itself, which is a bit of a non-traditional way to experience it. I actually did something similar with E3 a couple years ago. I've always found that the coolest parts of these get-togethers is just the people. So everybody flocks to San Francisco. You get to hang out with friends that you haven't seen in a while. You get to go to good restaurants. you can talk business with some people as well. I had several business meetings and a couple off-the-cuff interviews where people knew I was there and I knew they were there. And we just kind of hooked up and talked about the game. And I did a demo for PC Gamer. And yeah, it was really cool.
Awesome. I know when we spoke over email last week, you kind of had some trouble getting back.
Yeah. Part of the problem is that I fly standby, and that means if there's no room on the plane, you don't get on. And so we actually got trapped in Aspen, Colorado for a night on the way there, which normally doesn't sound too bad, except for the fact that it's Aspen, Colorado. So the cheapest hotel is $250 a night, which really stings. We got trapped for actually a few days on the way back because everybody's leaving San Francisco and the flights were just full. So yeah, it was a little bit of a challenge getting back, but I finally did, and then got back to some programming. But yeah, it was a fun trip, and I really enjoy all the conferences, travel, getting together, talking to people. It's one of the best parts about this business.
Yeah, I hope to at least do some more traveling over the next year. Hopefully, if the site starts to pick up, and hopefully if I can get some income coming in, I would love to attend more of the conferences around. The last one I went to was, I think, GDC 2, maybe 3 years ago. That was my last time I was sort of out and about.
Yeah. Money really is the limiting factor. So when you're part of a big company, a lot of times it's a lot easier to go out there. And I know when I was at Firaxis, I got out there pretty often, also for press tours. Now I actually have to pay for things in my own pocket, which definitely changes it. It's one of those things, and kind of have to weigh the value of going versus not, and that can be pretty tough, especially when you're a smaller game and you don't really know what the impact of you going will be. For me, honestly, this last trip was just kind of for fun, and the fact that I actually did any marketing for At the Gates was an added bonus, but I do enjoy the shows.
Yeah, the travel is also the other big thing. I just really don't like flying that much. I usually visit my grandparents, like maybe another year in Las Vegas. It's like a 5.5-6 hour plane ride there, and I just hate sitting on that plane for all those hours. But then again, I'd rather do it all in one sitting rather than having to take multiple flights, because I did that once a while ago and I just hated having to get off, get back on, and just repeat the whole damn thing over again.
it's not a lot of fun. When I went to San Francisco, like I said, I got trapped in Aspen. That was actually not the direct route. Actually flew from Detroit to Chicago, Chicago to Aspen, and then the goal was to get from Aspen to San Francisco all in one day. Didn't happen. Almost made it, but not quite. I'm fairly used to flying, though. My father worked for United Airlines, which is one of the reasons why I can fly standby. And so we were always going around to lots of different places, nothing too exotic. But and then when I was working at Firaxis, they would send me around to do different things, press tours and whatnot. So I did quite a bit of traveling that way. So I'm kind of used to those coast-to-coast 5-hour, 6-hour flights. The ones I can't handle, though, are the red eyes. I cannot sleep at all on planes. If I have my laptop, I'm fine, but I have to, if I'm tired, trying to get some shut-eye, it's impossible.
It's good that you mentioned that, because that's where my next little flight horror story was going. On my way back from GDC, I took the overnight flight. So I was sitting on the plane pretty much until like 7 o'clock in the morning. And I could not sleep at all. I had my PSP at the time, so I just stayed up all night playing Valkyria Chronicles 2. But I was like the only one on the plane awake, and I just, it was like that eerie for a second. When you look around, the whole plane is dark except for your little corner with the PSP light on.
Yeah, that's always me as well. I'm usually worse though. I got my laptop. It's a lot more light around me. People don't like that, but hey, you know,
yeah.
Planes aren't good for doing much else besides work or reading or. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever. It's not like you're gonna go out and cook up a steak or, you know, learn to play the violin or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think with that, let's talk a little bit about some game news. And the piece that I want to talk about, which I found fairly interesting, is this piece on US Gamer. And they were talking to Double Fine and about how they're getting into publishing now besides their general development. And there's a part of that that's pretty interesting, and they talked about the indie pricing issue, or how a lot of indie developers are pretty much rushing to get their game as cheap as possible, get the game, you know, 99 cents, sales, Humble Bundle, whatever. And this is an interesting debate, and it's one that we've been hearing about for the last few years, especially with the rise of the general sales structure. And the argument from a lot of people is that when games are being priced this low, or they're being bundled or sold, that they're devaluing the market. In the sense that if I release my game for $20 and you release your game for $4 or you're in a 99 cent sale, then what am I supposed to do? People are going to buy that cheaper game, or they may look down on the higher price saying, you know, you're just trying to rip people off or whatever. So there's some people who have argued against that. I know recently the developer, I think his name is Jason Rower, who did the Castle Doctrine, he basically wrote a post saying that he will never put his game on sale. It will be basically at discount price up until release, and then it will stay at that price, you know, forever and eternity. And it's just one of those things that we can see from both ways. So I guess to begin with, John, what are your thoughts on that?
I can definitely see where Double Fine is coming from on this, because it's had a very, very extreme impact on the mobile market, especially where the expectation is that a game will be free, and if not free, then no more than a dollar, which is, you know, ultimately something is worth what people are willing to pay for and what somebody is willing to sell it for. So, you know, it would be hard to argue that it's unfair or doesn't or devalues the effort put into it, because if somebody doesn't want to play it, then they don't want to play it. And therefore, that's what they think of your effort. But it does build up conditioning for what to expect. And this sort of thing happens with me as well. When I go and look through, you know, app stores and I see something that costs $5, my initial reaction is, wow, I can't believe it's $5. And then I step back and actually think about it and say, oh, wow, $5 is nothing. $5 is, you know, 20 minutes in the car, whatever. Yeah. And rationally, I know that, but I've come to expect these prices to be ridiculously low. So it definitely has an impact, and it's something that you do kind of want to push back against. But there's also the other end of it, where Valve has basically proven that these Steam sales produce more revenue lifetime for projects than they would otherwise make. And you can argue that, but they have a lot of math, and they have done a lot of presentations for a lot of people showing their findings and showing graphs and showing sales charts going up. And it's very convincing. You know, it's still numbers, so it's not 100%. You can't guarantee that for every project, but you know, it's pretty conclusive that it does have a benefit. So you kind of have these two forces that are working in opposition to one another. You have the incentive to have sales because it does show extra profit in the long run. But even over the longer run, it gets people to expect things to be a certain price. So over time, it has a dampening effect. So yeah, honestly, I kind of don't really know. I fall in between, really. At the gates, it's going to be $30 at release, which is kind of in between, you could say. It's not AAA, $50, $60, or, you know, kind of a matrix strategy release where it's $80, $100, whatever. But it's also not on the extreme low end. But we will be on Steam and we'll be part of sales and things like that. So it's tough. I don't really have a flag planted, but I can see why you'd want to push back against that and say, you know, long term, this is going to hurt us, hurt our brand, hurt the industry as a whole, where people come to think of things as more disposable. If somebody looks at a game and sees that everything's $50 and your game is $50, then it seems fair. If your game is $50 and everything else is $1, like you said, then it's very different.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of really weird for someone like me, who I grew up during the NES era, where games were like $70, $80 for a Super Nintendo game, because that was pretty much it. You couldn't buy games anywhere else. There was no such thing as digital distribution at the time. So it was either take it or you're not playing any video games for a few months. And it is kind of weird how we've sort of been rewired in a sense in terms of pricing. I remember back in like the early thousands when I got my first job at EB, and you know, every paycheck I was basically blowing it back on like a $40, $50 game, because that was the price there. I didn't expect it to go down anymore, and that was pretty much it. And now we flash forward to today, and now if a game is more than $10, you know, my brain just pretty much locks or puts a stop on me, saying, no, you can't spend more than $10 on a game. Look at all these games for $3.99, $2.99, whatever. And it's becoming a lot harder to recondition myself to put more value into those games. Like, if I see a game for $15, $20, I'm a little bit more judgmental, or, you know, what is this game actually going to give me? And as opposed to if a game's only $3 or $5, and it's, you know, $5, as you said, it's like 20 minutes of work almost. You can rationalize like that, and you have the game.
Yeah, the problem is that there's very, very powerful forces at work here, and kind of drawing a line in the sand for your games or for your company is kind of a tough sell. Ultimately, we can't really control what's going to happen, and one economic principle is that the price of everything generally drifts down towards the cost of goods. Mm-hmm. And the cost of goods for a digital piece of software is zero.
Yeah.
So naturally, that's there are forces pushing it in that direction. And this is especially true when you look at who the gatekeepers are now. You have companies like Apple, and you have companies like Valve, where they make their money basically on volume. And Apple, I mean, Apple is almost completely different, where their value is provided by their hardware. And when you buy the hardware, you spend several hundred dollars on this shiny piece of glass and aluminum, and Apple has kind of pushed things into a position where it's kind of assumed that the software will be free. It's bundled in with this really expensive thing you already bought. So the whole App Store system is kind of a brilliant move on their part to kind of add more value to their platform without really having to do any work. And hey, they make a little bit of money on the side too. It's dwarfed by what they make off of hardware, but it certainly adds up. Whereas Valve, it's just pure volume. Mm-hmm. If they sell, let's say, $1 billion of software in $50 chunks, or $1 billion in software in $1 chunks, it really doesn't matter. They still get the same amount. And that's kind of, you know, it's working against you there as well. And I'm a pragmatist at the end of the day. So my approach is always, I will work within the bounds as much as possible and try to do what's best for what I'm trying at the time. So for At the Gates, if I tried to sell At the Gates for $60, then that would probably, you know, get a lot of eyebrows raised. And that's not my goal. My goal is to put out a really good game that will sell, you know, well enough to keep going. And I would like to say, hey, this is a game that has just as much work put into it as other big $50, $60 games. You know, it'll end up being about 3.5 years development time on it, which is pretty crazy when you think about it. And I would like to say, hey, you know, there's a lot of value here, but I'm not going to, you know, fight that fight and potentially alienate people in the process. My goal is to do work within the bounds as best as possible. And, you know, again, that does have some long-term consequences, but I'm only one man.
Yeah, and I think what you just said is very interesting regarding the price, and how you could say that At the Gates has the value of a $50, $60 game. I think this is one of the issues with video game pricing is that it's very subjective in terms of what is worth 30, 40, 50, whatever. It's not like a physical media or a physical product where you can say, oh, this car is, you know, the super car of today. It's easily worth whatever. I have no sense of car pricing. But, you know, it could be worth tens of thousands of dollars. And, I mean, you can say that by, you know, the equipment that's put into it, the amount of work it took designing it. But when you look at a video game, who's to say that, let's just say, like, Don't Starve, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, is worth this amount of money versus a game like Escape Goat 2 that came out, which I think is worth $14, $15. There's no way to really qualify, you know, what kind of game design is worth more or what's worth less.
Yeah, we look at what's out there and then we use that as a baseline, which is why it's important that everything isn't free, because then free is what we come to expect, and that certainly makes things a lot harder on game developers. But yeah, I mean, value is what people think of it as. So, you know, you could argue that At the Gates has more value than $60. You could say hundreds or thousands, like you said, based on how much you play the game and what you get out of it and how many similar types of games there are or aren't. But it comes down to what people are willing to pay. And you have to deal with that reality. And if you try to fight that, then, you know, maybe it will help, maybe it won't. There's also a good chance that it hurts you. So you kind of have to balance those forces. And for me, I'm actually pretty thankful that I'm in this corner of the business where I'm making PC strategy games, because there is certainly still a strong market that believes that these games are valuable and worth large chunks of money and not just, hey, you know, everything has to be a dollar. They sell well. People play them a long time. They talk about them for a while. And that's certainly something that that helps me out. But, you know, if that changes down the road, then it changes down the road and I'll have to adapt to it. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. And I think a good example that you mentioned a few minutes ago is like the Paradox and Strategy First model. Their strategy games are usually like $60, $70. I know at least Strategy First, all their games are always on the high end. Because as you said, the strategy genre, it is somewhat niche, but at the same time, the people who enjoy those games, they're going to buy a game and they're going to enjoy it for, you know, months on end. So they're really going to get their value out of a game that's priced $60, $70 compared to someone who may be casual who, you know, they may spend 5 minutes playing a game and then they'll move on to the next game type deal.
Yeah. Who your audience is incredibly important. And having a really mature audience definitely works in my favor, both on the development side and just trying to sell the game. And I don't envy what a lot of other people have to deal with, certainly in mobile especially. I can't even imagine. That seems like a nightmare to me. trying to make money in that space. You know, I'm pretty confident that At the Gates will do well, and future projects on PC will do well. But if somebody said, all right, PCs disappeared tomorrow. Now you have to only make games for iOS. I'd be very scared, and I'd probably be thinking about other career paths, because it's just so volatile. Yeah. It's just quality doesn't matter as much, because the ecosystem is controlled by another party that can decide what they want in their market and what they don't on the featured list, which is so important. And if you have a great game that isn't featured, then it could disappear and be gone. That's it. Unfortunately, that's what happens with most of them.
Yep. I spoke with a developer who works at eRepublic Labs a few weeks ago, which they're a mobile developer, and he pretty much said the same exact thing. The mobile market moves so quickly that you may have a game up on the feature page for maybe a day, 2 days tops, and then, you know, it's off, and it's not going to go back on, even if your game sells. If it's like the best-selling game on iOS, it's just not going to be back on there, because they've got 50, 60 other little games popping up every day to challenge that. And as you said, those people are expecting these games to be, you know, 50, 60 cents, 99 cents is like considered top of the mark for them. So even if your game is really good, the second they see it's, you know, $20, $30, whatever, they're going to be like, whoa, you know, I'm not going to spend that on a little game on my phone or my iOS device.
Yep. Like I said, though, it just is what it is. Yep. And I admire the people who are pushing back a little bit, but it may hurt them in the long run. I guess we'll have to see. I certainly wish them luck, and I'm kind of half pushing. I can't promise that At the Gates will never go on sale because, you know, ultimately my priority is making games and keep staying in business. And if that means following the market there, then that's what I'll have to do.
Yep. Now, one thing that you said a few minutes ago that I want to come back to is regarding people who are willing to pay the money, or the hardcore fans, because that's a discussion that also fits into the piracy debate. And it's something that I find interesting, and I believe that there's always going to be people who are going to buy your game day one, you know, full price. They're just going to be there and buy it. And there's always going to be that segment of the market who's going to either wait for a sale or, quite frankly, pirate the game and pretty much give you zero revenue from that. It's kind of weird how, as we've talked about, people are wired like that. I had an ex-friend who, he would pretty much pirate any game. It didn't matter the quality, it didn't matter what price it was. If it was up on a pirating site, he was going to get it. And I remember talking to him, like, dude, it's $2 on Steam. You make, you know, $100 in like a few days. You pretty much made like $100 a day working. I think you can splurge on it. He goes, no, I'll just pirate it. You know, I don't care. So it's kind of crazy how that talk is feeding back into this, and how the perception of the fans, as we said, ultimately the consumer will dictate what the value of the game is. And it's going to be very interesting to see how prices are going to fluctuate. Because I remember, I think a few months ago, weeks ago, they were talking about maybe raising the price on retail. Because as we know, the standard retail game or AAA game is $60 right now. And I think that may be a little bit crazy in this market to try to say, oh, we're going to make it, you know, $70 or $80 for a retail game.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm a pragmatist. So a lot of people are, you know, very, very, very upset about piracy. And I'm certainly no fan of it myself. But like you said, some people are just going to pirate things. And some people are going to buy the game on day one, no matter how much it costs. And as a developer, it's up to you to figure out where that middle ground is, where you can stay in business. Ultimately, there is no right answer. Selling your game for $60 isn't good or bad, you know, good or evil.
Yeah.
Just like $3 isn't good or evil, or $1 isn't good or evil. It's just, you know, it's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree that trying to raise the prices now might not go over very well, but it's kind of the struggle that retail faces in a way, because that pie gets cut up so many ways, and inflation certainly doesn't help, and the inflation of game development budgets also doesn't help, because you're spending $50 million making a game, then you have to sell a lot of copies at a very high price to make that back.
And I think I read that the recent release of The Elder Scrolls Online, I think 200 or like $300 million. It was like a huge amount to make that game, when they're, of course, betting on having a subscription model, which the MMO market has sort of transitioned away from in favor of free-to-play or expansion content. So that's another one that I think it's either going to do very well or it's going to fail spectacularly when no one wants a subscription model on an MMO.
Yeah, that was actually something that I've been paying pretty close attention to this past week, because the ZeniMax Online, the studio that developed Elder Scrolls Online, was actually set up across the street from Firaxis about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that. And so I actually have a lot of friends over there, and I've been watching the development for quite some time now. And yeah, big subscription MMO at this point. Boy, oof.
Yeah.
that feels like one of those things where, you know, that might go over worse than trying to raise the price on retail, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, based on what I've read about the game as well, it sounds like it's not really breaking a lot of new ground either, which doesn't help either. It's taken what World of Warcraft has done and shuffling things around a little bit. It doesn't really have, or it still has a lot of the tropes that you have seen in MMOs, where you kind of have to follow the gated progress. You can't just wander around and explore, and the quests are kind of and the combat's kind of You know, it's just another MMO. It feels like that's going to be an uphill battle for them.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting that I'm finally starting to hear like little murmurs that World of Warcraft, their subscription base is finally starting to decline just a little bit, but they're still considered the top dog. And I think at this point, the only other MMO that is subscription-based. I know The Secret World, they went to free-to-play DC Universe. So I don't know, are there any other MMOs that are subscription model? Do you know?
Is EVE subscription?
It could be, although...
I think it might have a hybrid. I honestly don't pay too much attention. I know that they've done a lot of interesting things and angered people and mm-hmm. made them happy again and then angered them again over the years. But yeah, I can't think of anything else that I'm certain has a subscription still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Before we move on, then, I have one last question for you, John. In mm-hmm. the article, Double Fine talk about trying to keep, I guess, what they call premium indie, or keep a premium price for indie games. When you hear that phrase of a premium price for an independent game, in your opinion, what do you think that price point is for an independent game to be considered premium?
Well, I think it's actually somewhere around where At the Gates is, mm-hmm. You know, $30, $40, somewhere in that range. So many indies do fall way below that, either 15 or 10 or less, mm-hmm. Even at release, that, yeah, you know, $30 would definitely be considered indie,
yeah.
or a premium for indie. And I've received a couple comments from people saying that, you know, $30 for At the Gates is way too much money. You know, again, yeah. I kind of laugh at that a little bit, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's their opinion.
Yeah.
If it were $5, they would buy it, and at $30, they won't, and that's... You know, that's legitimate. And if everyone thought that way, it would be reality and I'd have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But again, it also depends on the kind of game that you're making. Strategy games aren't super common, especially the big 4X empire mm-hmm. builder style. Mm-hmm. And so there will always be a market for that type of game. And there will always be people that really want it. So as long as there's not a bunch of $5 4X games coming out, then I'm not too concerned. If I were making a platformer or something like that, it would be a lot harder, a lot tougher sell. But yeah, I think somewhere in that $30, $40 range is probably what we're talking about, you know, at least in my mind.
Yep, and I would agree with you on that. I wrote a piece a few months ago where I sort of, in my head, put like together a little pricing guide where I considered, you know, top retail $60. Double A maybe $40, $45, and like around $30, $35, I think would be considered like top for an independent game. And that kind of raises another question. Do you think we will ever see someone be crazy enough to release an independent game at, you know, $50, $60?
I mean, it probably does happen and mm-hmm. it just isn't as common. I mean, you could look at games like Planetary Annihilation when they went to early access. Yeah. It was, what, $80, $90? I forget it.
I think it was like 90 and 80 or 90, and people just went, you know, bonkers over that.
Yep, yeah. And the whole discussion ties in very closely with Kickstarter and early access and crowdfunding and those sorts of things, because with At the Gates, the average Kickstarter you know, pledge was something like $35, but the range was pretty extreme. There were fewer people who were willing to pay a lot more, and then a lot of people that were willing to pay a lot less. Mm-hmm. And it all kind of evened out to that number, which is, you know, pretty good from where I'm standing. Mm-hmm. But it's a question again of what people are interested in and how much they're willing to make it worth. And the whole crowdfunding thing has really opened up new opportunities, especially for smaller developers, mm-hmm. But also for, you know, larger, more established ones to say, all right, well, this game is worth more to you. You can give us $500 for it or $100 or whatever, mm-hmm. You know, give us the traditional $50 price point for a game that normally is $30. You know, that was something that I did with the At the Gates Kickstarter, mm-hmm. and that potentially has a lot of opportunity, but a lot of it comes down to perception again. If you're a really big publisher, you know, if you're Electronic Arts and you do this sort of thing, people are going to cry foul on it. And even if you're kind of more mid-tier, because I know that some other companies like Stardock, when they announced Galactic Civilizations 3 and they have this $100
Yeah, the early access.
Early access pack. There's a lot of people like, well, they don't need that. They have all the money they need.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas another game that has a Kickstarter tier for $100, nobody bats an eye at.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's that battle of perception. Mm-hmm. Things have really changed a lot over the past 10 years, 5 years especially, and it's really muddied the waters, and I really have no idea where things are going. Personally, I just hope they kind of stay similar or keep things roughly as they are long enough for me to at least make a few more projects and kind of stabilize the company and have a little bit of backup just in case things do change rapidly, and they probably will. It's just the nature of the business.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And before we move on, one last question that I'm curious about. This pretty much is a semantics question from my opinion. When we consider Firaxis, are they considered a AAA developer, or are they considered more AA? But it's always weird when you're trying to brand some of these bigger PC developers.
I would definitely say AAA.
Okay.
They don't have the absolutely insane budgets like Elder Scrolls Online, but they're still, you know, in the in the $20, $30, $40 million range. And that's a lot. And certainly, unless you're talking StarCraft, there's nobody in the strategy genre that comes close. And things have changed a lot in that regard the past 5-10 years as well, where there was a very clear line between AAA and everything else. Mm-hmm. And it usually came down to retail and graphics. And you could have made the case that Firaxis wasn't in that bucket back in the days of Civ 3 and Civ 4. But you know, when you look at Civ 5 and XCOM and compared to what else is out there, I think they're definitely in that category. They're part of a big publisher, they have multi-million dollar budgets, and they sell millions of copies. That checks all the boxes in my book.
Awesome. So let's move on. I know if Ken was here, he would have to ask you this. I know when I talked to you the last time, we sort of talked briefly about the Oculus Rift and your thoughts on it. So I was just wondering, regarding the Facebook buyout of it, I was wondering, do you have any interesting thoughts or anything you'd like to add about that?
Well, one thing I do wonder about is what Facebook is up to. Just it almost kind of seems like Google, where they have so much money and they just buy something completely random.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's certainly opportunities there, but it's a very big investment, and it could be something that is the core of their business in 10, 15 years, or it could be something that disappears and dies off within a few. And right now, it's really a big question mark as to what they're planning on doing with it. As for the Oculus end of things, I think having the resources, the money to flesh this product out will be a good thing. Because hardware is very, very difficult. You could just look at something like the Ouya and see, even with, you know, millions of dollars, the console still had a pretty rough launch, and they're having a lot of trouble getting traction. And that's still a fraction of the amount of money that, for example, companies like Sega put into the Dreamcast, which failed miserably and lost a lot of money. So I think having that extra money will be a huge boost and really raise their chances of, you know, quote unquote, making it, of, you know, reaching mainstream or something close to it, or at least getting it enough out there that it's as common as something like, you know, I don't know, a joystick. You know, right now it's, there are a lot more joysticks out there than Oculus Rifts. So, you know, even that requires a little bit of catching up to do. But hardware is expensive. It's really difficult. There's always delays and problems, and costs you more time and money than you think it will. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. I'm pretty excited for what it has to offer. I really love technology and gadgets and all those sorts of things. I like to be on the cutting edge there. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see. It's not something I think will make sense for something like At the Gates, but you know, there's a lot of good opportunities out there. So we'll just have to see how they play out in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. And even though I agree with you about the Sega Dreamcast, kind of hurt my heart there, thinking about how much the Dreamcast failed, because that was still one of my favorite systems, at least at the time.
Yep. You know, it's like we've been talking about, just because something is good doesn't mean it's successful. Alas.
Yep, amen to that. All right, let's move on and talk a bit about some of the games we've been playing. So, John, would you mind going first?
Sure. So, The game, I've been playing a few games. The one most recently that I played the most is Rogue Legacy, mm-hmm. which isn't a brand new game, but it's new to me at least. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got into it because I'm a humongous Spelunky fan, and somebody who knows me who knows that I'm a humongous Spelunky fan said that, hey, you should try out this game also. And it's been fun, but there are certain elements to it that I'm not as sure about. Mm-hmm. One of them is that you kind of have to grind a little bit in order to build up your character. Mm-hmm. The thing I like about Spelunky is that it's 100% skill-based.
Yeah.
There's nothing to level up. There's nothing to, you know, grind. There's nothing to unlock. It's just, hey, what do you know about this game? What do you know about the enemies that are in it, the traps, mm-hmm. How to use the items, the timings of certain things? It's all, you know, it's all in your brain. And I really like that. I'm not as much of a fan of the more RPG model where you just kind of do things and then this magical number goes up and suddenly you're a lot better. Mm-hmm. So unlocking new equipment and skills, those sorts of things, is kind of cool in a way, but it also feels less pure, less interesting mm-hmm. from a game design perspective, and less likely to keep me playing it, because it does at times feel more like a grind than I'm getting better at this game. And I am getting better, and mm-hmm. skill certainly does play a role, but it is different from a game like Spelunky. So my thoughts on it are kind of mixed. It's very difficult, mm-hmm. which I do like. I'm getting better. But it does have kind of that grind issue, and the production quality is a little bit lower. Mm-hmm. I don't really care about things like the art so much, but the controls just don't feel as tight as a game like Spelunky yeah. or a Mario game. Mm-hmm. It feels like when I move much further than I really wanted to. Mm-hmm. And when I jump, you know, my precision is less, and that's kind of something that's just intrinsic to the game. And it reminds you of how difficult it is to build even, you know, quote unquote, simple games like platformers, mm-hmm. where feel is so important. Just a little tiny thing like how far you move and what the acceleration and deceleration rates are when you run, it has a huge impact on what the game feels like. And you can't underestimate that. It's not easy. It's not simple, mm-hmm. But it's easy to overlook, unfortunately. So I've enjoyed the game thus far, in spite of those things. Again, it is a platformer. It is randomized. It is very difficult, mm-hmm. All things that I really like. So it does naturally attract me, but those couple things have kind of dampened my excitement for it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm about the same way with that as well. Have you seen the game? I think it's called Valdis Story on Steam. Abyssal City, something like that?
No, I don't think so.
It was a Metroidvania type game, and I have like the similar control problems with that that you do with Rogue Legacy, and how it doesn't feel like you have complete control of your character. And I know that's a very generic response, but as you said, it's really hard to explain what makes a good control scheme or what makes a game, I guess, quote-unquote, feel right in your hands.
Yeah, it's... You know, I feel like I'm pretty good at designing strategy games, mm-hmm. But a platformer, for example, is a completely different experience and requires completely different game design skills. Same thing with a shooter, same thing with an RPG. So I feel like if I were to just jump in and try to make a platformer, because, mm-hmm. you know, hey, it could happen, I love platformers, I feel like it probably wouldn't be very good for that reason. I don't have that built-in knowledge mm-hmm. accumulated over time, over years of making these sorts of games, and mm-hmm. and well, okay, this, you know, I moved too far, it doesn't feel right, you know, actually figuring out what that means and how to change the game and make it feel better. Mm-hmm. I just don't have that skill set, so I'd probably end up with something very similar.
Mm-hmm. Have you played Super Meat Boy before?
I haven't. That's actually the next one on my list.
Awesome.
I was told to play Rogue Legacy and Super Meat Boy, so Super Meat Boy is number 3 right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, so I'll be curious to hear what your thoughts are going to be on that, because I think Super Meat Boy is one of those examples of really tight gameplay, really tight controls, in the sense that, as we just said, it's one of those games that it feels like when you move the guy, he moves exactly how you want him to move. It's not like, it really isn't no sense of error, like, you know, oh, I hit control a little bit wrong and the guy, you know, jumped in the complete opposite direction or something like that.
Yeah, I wonder, I don't actually know what the development history behind the people that made that. Was that their first game, do you know? Was that...
For Rogue Legacy?
No, the Super Meat Boy.
That, I believe, that was their first major release. I know they've worked on like several smaller games before then. They released something called the Basement Collection, I think last year on Steam, which is like the collection of all their older titles that they made. So they have made a few platformers, or puzzle platformer games in a sense, but I think Super Meat Boy was their first major, like, almost like Mario-inspired platform.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay, I looked them up real quick, and it looks like they made a game called Meat Boy, which was a Flash game back in 2008, and then they made Super Meat Boy, which came out in 2010, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if the original Meat Boy in Flash didn't actually feel as polished, have that tightness, didn't have that good feel to it. And, you know, maybe they learned as they went, and, you know, it was a two-year gap between the two.
Yeah.
That's quite a bit of time. It's a good time to iterate and polish there. So, you know, maybe they were naturally gifted, or maybe they figured it out and got better as time went on. But, yeah, it's, like I said, it the game's... seems simple, but making them is certainly not.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to Rogue Legacy, have you played the game, another game from Team Meat, The Binding of Isaac?
Mm-mm, I haven't. Another very, very odd game.
Yeah, definitely.
At least visually.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, another one that I've been told I need to play.
Mm-hmm.
I do too much programming and I'm not playing, it seems.
The reason why I brought that up is because The Binding of Isaac has a similar structure of unlocking new content as you play, but I felt that it was handled a lot better compared to Rogue Legacy. In Isaac, essentially, every time you do an accomplishment, you beat a boss, you beat the game, whatever, you unlock new items and new things that will basically be inserted into the randomization for subsequent games. It's not like Rogue Legacy, where I felt that, as you said, there's a lot of grinding to get enough money to raise the tower or unlock a new room in your castle, which is essentially your whole upgrade screen. And I think with that, it felt like I basically did runs for the sole purpose of getting money. Like, I didn't care about beating the game. I knew this character wasn't going to beat the bosses and all that. I just said, just send him on a suicide run, get as much money, and then kill him and start again.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's clear that part of their game design model was, okay, you're going to play this game, you know, a bunch of times. You're going to lose a lot. How do we turn that into something that's actually meaningful? So that just dying all the time isn't, okay, you died, now start over. No, you didn't actually accomplish anything. But I feel like, at least for me, the whole point of games that are really hard, of the roguelikes, is that they are games that are so skill-based, where you start playing and you don't know what you're doing and you lose a lot, but as you go, little by little, you get better, you learn the quirks, you learn the nuances, you learn the controls, you learn the items, you learn the enemies, you learn the patterns, and then eventually you've mastered this thing. It's basically the perfect example of how games can be entertaining as tools for mastery. But when you kind of insert a grind into it, it warps that in a way. It changes the focus from, hey, I want to get better at this, I want to learn the enemies, I want to figure out how this works, to simply, all right, well, I'm just, you know, going to go do this thing to get a little bit more money in order to do this. And there are certain elements in Rogue Legacy that try to work counter to that, where you don't keep your money long term. It goes away after your next run. But I feel like those two things are almost working in opposition to one another, where you're encouraging players to do a certain thing, but then you're pushing back and saying, okay, well, don't do that quite as much. And it, again, compared with a game like Spelunky, it doesn't feel as pure, it doesn't feel as tight. And, you know, making a game that is tight is really, really difficult. If you do it wrong, then the game is just boring and there's not much there to do. And making a game like Spelunky is really difficult, where you have a good mix of enemies and you have a good mix of challenges and puzzles and items, and nothing is too strong and nothing is too weak. And you can learn things, but not too quickly and not too slowly. And, you know, it's it's a big challenge. So I can see why they wanted to take the approach of making it a little bit more structured, if you will. But again, I do think it kind of works counter to what makes the genre good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that desire to keep replaying is very tough to balance. Because as you said, if you're making the game entirely skill-based, then you're just saying, you die, well, it's your fault, you know, suck it up, learn, and get better at it. But then when you start introducing RPG or abstracted systems into it, then it becomes, oh, you died, well, you need to spend a few more hours, level your sword up a few more, and then maybe you can try the boss, and then, you know, keep going in that direction.
Yep. And like I said, it's a tough thing to do. It's not a type of game that I think I'd be very good at least mm-hmm. At first. So, I might try my hand at someday down the road just because, mm-hmm. I might run out of other things to do or not. But I can understand the challenge of it, and I appreciate that they try to do something new. I don't think it quite worked, at least for me, but they don't need my support. I think the game's done fairly well anyway. So it's an interesting game design, playground, mm-hmm. If you will, to kind of explore some of these things and see how they turned out.
Yeah. One last thing about Rogue Legacy. What did you think of the almost bullet hell-inspired design, how most of the enemies attack were just filling the screen with projectiles and all that other stuff?
I mean, I think it's kind of neat. They clearly borrowed from a lot of different games, a lot of different genres, a lot of different source material, and that's cool. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. It's certainly kind of fits in with the rest of the game in a way where, I think in part because of the controls, either intentionally or not, you're more rewarded for being very patient and very precise than you are for being purely skilled.
A bull in a china shop, almost?
Yeah, I mean, like, in I keep going back to Spelunky, but it's certainly the most similar game that I can think of. You can really do a lot in terms of agility and just kind of fly around and blast things, and you have the shotgun, you're shooting things in every direction, and you can certainly do that to some extent in Rogue Legacy as well, but taking damage I feel like is a lot easier in Rogue Legacy, where I've gone entire games in Spelunky where I haven't been hit once. Part of that is, again, it's very skill based, but I feel like I can move faster, I can learn the patterns, I can do things more safely, whereas in Rogue Legacy, there's a ghoul that will just pop up out of the ground and hit you and do damage to you, and there's literally no way of knowing it's there. So you just kind of have to inch along slowly and see if, hey, is a ghoul gonna pop out of the ground here? Whereas in Spelunky, you see everything, you can kind of know and be precise and run through and blast through really quickly. And there's certainly still hazards, but There's an achievement for how quickly you can beat the game. You can beat it in less than 6 minutes, you get an achievement, and I actually earned that achievement.
Nice.
And there's elements of luck involved with it, but you can do it. Whereas in Rogue Legacy, again, it feels like it really wants to make you slower, even in spite of some of these abilities that allow you to move around really fast. So kind of has an identity crisis almost.
Yeah, speaking about Spelunky in terms of its health system, I think another part of that is that because of how health works in the game, and when you get hit, you actually physically like knocked around, every hit could very well be that death blow. Because I've had cases where my favorite death was when I threw a rock against the wall, it bounced back, hit me in the head, knocked me off the platform I was on, I fell into a bed of spikes and died. And I didn't even get angry, I was just sitting there going, that will never happen again. I will never be able to time that just right.
Yeah. So much in the game is predictable that, you can curse out certain things the first time you run into them, but, it's fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And as you learn all these little tricks, you're like, okay, well, I'm not going to throw rocks directly at walls anymore. And things are very precise and predictable. And if you do things a certain way, you'll get rewarded for it. So in a sense, that does reward patience as well, but as you get better, you can be faster and faster and faster. Yeah. And I feel like with Rogue Legacy, I don't have that same opportunity. I feel like I'm still encouraged to kind of go through slowly and patiently.
Yeah, I think a great example of that sort of increasing your skill, increasing your speed aspect in Spelunky is with going after the diamond, or basically letting the ghost spawn and then basically having him chase you around to get the diamonds for a better score. When you first start playing Spelunky, you're like, no, why would I want to let this thing that can kill me in the level? I just want to get it done as quickly as possible, let me get in, get out. But then once you start learning the game and you start going for the higher score, then you start to get a little cocky and say, okay, let this guy spawn, I'll play around with him and see how high I can get my score for this run.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. That's actually one of the few things I don't like very much about Spelunky, mainly because it kind of wanders more into that grinding direction where you rack up as high of a score as possible, yeah, you want the ghost to run around and touch all the gems and turn them into diamonds. And at a certain point, it kind of becomes, all right, well, you know, I'm dragging this out and out and out, and it becomes less about skill and more about patience again. You have to be really, really, really patient to maximize that. And you know, that's one of the reasons I actually stopped playing Spelunky and stopped doing the daily challenges, because you know, I could get these really ridiculously high scores of a million points, but it was just more of a, all right, well,
how much time do I have to throw
in? Yeah, I'm just going to start grinding from the beginning. It became less about skill than about just doing everything very methodically, which isn't really what I like about the game.
Yeah.
So I actually kind of drifted more in the speedrun direction, where I try to get faster and faster and faster, because you really do have to be very good in order to beat the game quickly.
Yeah.
there's more luck involved, but there's also more skill. It's not about, all right, what am I willing to do? It's more about, okay, how good am I?
Yep. And if we're talking about Spelunky accomplishments, I have to mention the point where I stopped playing was when I actually managed to beat the hell level, or the secret bonus level. After I did that, I was like, you know, I'm never going to get a better run than this. I'm out, you know. Let me take my little prize and go home.
Yeah, it took me about 1,500 games to beat the game the hard way. So I've been there. I stuck with it for a little bit longer, partially because the game did have the daily challenges on Steam, and it was fun kind of, you know, racking up scores and comparing them with each other. But after I'd beaten the game the hard way several times and it became just about points, that's when the fun kind of faded away a little bit. The skill disappeared. Getting better, getting more skilled at the game didn't reflect in my score anymore. And, you know, there wasn't really much left to do. I'd seen everything. I'd beaten everything. I'd done just about everything that made sense except for some of the really, really obscure things. But that was, you know, I got my 700, 800 hours out of it. I can't complain. Yep.
And one other thing regarding skill-based games I want to ask you, John, is about where I feel when skill basically gets taken too far to the extreme. And this is coincidentally with another bullet hell game. This was the game Sign Moria. Have you heard of that game?
It sounds familiar, but maybe give me a quick summary.
It's essentially a bullet hell shooter. The whole hook of the game has to do with time travel, and you're on this planet where it's basically animals piloting all these ships, or like humanoid animal type creatures. And the twist of the game, or the challenge, is the fact that playing the game at the absolute highest difficulty, it becomes less about, I guess, learning the game, more about figuring out the exact pattern and getting it down to a T. It's one of those games that every time you get hit, you lose your power-ups, which means your guns do less damage. So it's very easy to get into that negative feedback loop of, you're not able to kill the enemy, so you're going to get hit more and lose more time and eventually die. And I felt that was an example of taking skill base too far. It felt like instead of trying to play this game and get better at it, it felt like I had to follow a very strict regimen of how to play the game. Like if I got hit once, I should pretty much just restart the level. It was designed around those old school bullet hell games where you pretty much want to get through the game on one life, or you may not be able to get through the game.
Yeah, and I think that, like you said, that kind of swings around almost to the opposite extreme, where it does come down to just memorization again. You have to have the dexterity to get away from the bullets and actually perform the things. But yeah, knowing what's going to happen becomes more important than anything else. And what makes games fun for me is the need to adapt, the need to do something different, to apply the skills I've learned in different ways.
Yeah.
And that's why, again, Spelunky is so great, because it has some patterns, it has some skill-based elements, but it mixes up the levels, and it mixes up the enemies, and it mixes up the items, so the situation is constantly changing. Once you've kind of figured everything out, that's when a game stops being fun.
Yeah.
And overcoming challenges, experiencing something new, is the whole point. So if it comes down to just memorizing patterns, then there's really not that much there new to do. You're just memorizing a new pattern, but it's still the same process. It's still the same skill, the same muscle that you're exercising.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it kind of swings back around to the other end.
Cool. All right. With that, I want to talk briefly about the game that I've been playing, because this sort of will feed into my discussion on strategy design in a few minutes. And the game that I've been playing is Don't Starve's expansion. That it's considered early access, but they're calling it a beta. It's called Realm of Giants. And have you played Don't Starve before, John?
I have, actually, yeah. Quite a bit.
Awesome.
Not the expansion, though, so I'm actually excited to hear what's new.
Okay. So for those of you who haven't followed, Don't Starve is, essentially, it's a survivalist roguelike. I think that may be the cleanest explanation of it. The idea is that you're stuck in this world. It's pretty much like out of like a Tim Burton nightmare almost. Everything has like this very like cartoon or hand-drawn style to it. And the challenge is that you pretty much have to survive for as long as you can. You're tracked on health, your hunger, and then of course your sanity, because it's a dark, almost Lovecraftian type world. And every time you're exposed to a monster or you're in some kind of weird situation, your sanity will go down. When it gets too low, you'll start seeing things that aren't really there, and generally things get even creepier. So the challenge of the game is the fact that every night you need to have a fire set up, because if you're in complete darkness, there's something out there that's going to basically kill you. So the game is all about essentially this constant cycle of gather materials, hopefully get enough for food and light, and basically survive until the next day and the next and so on. Now, there is an adventure mode that sort of streamlines that down into, okay, find 5 items in this set world, or set in the sense it has a theme to it, but it's still a randomly generated world. And the game is pretty much about that. There's no, I guess, quote-unquote endgame. You can just theoretically just sit there in one world, play until you've completely harvested every resource out of it. They offer some of a new game, I heard, in the sense that you can move on to, like, a harder world, but there's no achievements, no real stat tracking or anything like that. And going back to Realm of Giants, what they decided to do with it was sort of fix one of the issues with the original design, which was when you basically know what you're doing. As we talk about, once you learn everything about the game and sort of become power memorization, with Don't Starve, it sort of felt that way. Once you know what resources to gather, what was the best things to craft, you could theoretically just survive forever or until resources ran out. I've heard some people get up like into like the hundreds of days survive. And I think my best was like day 20, day 25, and then I just got bored of the game really at that point. So the first thing they've added are 2 new seasons. Before, the game basically took place in either fall or winter. It's now year-round, so it can be a summer and spring along with that. And the new seasons basically add new enemies will pop up. It'll also introduce new threats. In spring, it rains a lot more, so if you're not careful and you don't build like jackets or umbrellas, your guy can basically freeze from the wind, from the rain, just completely soaking to the bone. While in summertime, basically all your crops die, and you'll have to rely on hunting and killing various animals for meat, and there you can basically suffer from heat exhaustion from the intense sun, so you have to instead build items that will keep you cold as opposed to keeping you warm. The other thing they've added in are the giants, which was sort of Don't Starve's quote-unquote boss fights. Now there's a giant that can appear in any of the four seasons, and if you can kill them, they drop, I think, like a rare item or something you can't acquire otherwise, which is pretty cool. The other thing that they added a few months ago, which isn't a part of the expansion but was still new content, was a cave system. So there's an entirely other ecosystem which you can unlock that has new items and all that stuff to it. And that is also pretty cool. So before I talk about my reservations with it, John, what do you think about Don't Starve? What do you like or don't like about it?
My experience pretty much mirrored yours, mm-hmm. where the game is really, really cool because it has a few specific features that are right up my alley. It has cyclical environment changes, you know, seasons, if you will, mm-hmm. And random maps, two things that are featured heavily in my, you know, my new mm-hmm. game. And there's a certain element of difficulty to it, and there's a certain element of structure to it. So there's the seasons, there's also day and night. So you have these different cycles, these different time periods where you're doing different things. There's this pressure of, okay, I need to get back to my camp before dark, or I need to, you know, there's this sense of I need to do something. The problem is that before too long, yeah, that kind of, all right, well, mm-hmm. I go to my campfire at night, I find these resources, I build these things, and then, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I've kind of done what there is to do. Mm-hmm. And another issue I had with it that's kind of related is that the progression of the game kind of played out the same way every time, mm-hmm. where, okay, I get these resources, I build my camp here because it gives me easy access to this, I set mm-hmm. up my rabbit traps, I do this, I do that, and then, okay, I have my early game down. And, you know, something I touched on earlier is adaptation is really important in games. If mm-hmm. you're doing the same thing every time, it mm-hmm. doesn't, it's not interesting anymore. So you have to find ways of spicing things up and mixing things up. And, you know, that's something that I was hoping that they would address in the expansion. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it's a game, it feels like it has a ton of potential.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot of things I really like, but not as much structure. And not as much really variety mm-hmm. for being a random map. It feels like a lot of the world was similar,
mm-hmm.
and there weren't a lot of unique elements that made a big difference for me. It's like, okay, I'm passing through another forest. Okay, I'm passing through another, you know, broad,
yeah.
dry grass area with the you know these beefaloes and rabbits and stuff. And you know, with a game that has a random map, you want to feel like every area is different. Mm-hmm. Instead, it kind of felt like every area was the same.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up progression, because that's actually one of my complaints I'm worrying about in my analysis of Realm of Giants for next week, because I feel the exact same way regarding its progression model. I think the problem for me, as you said, it becomes very routine, and it never really grows while you're playing. For those of you who haven't played the game, essentially, the harvestable resources, wood, grass, and stone, I believe, they all are used to make the tier 2 resources. So you can refine them into planks of wood, cut stone, and rope. And then those resources are essentially used for tier 3 and up. But the thing is, you always need the tier 1 resources as a base for that. And because of that, as you said, John, it gets very repetitive. Like, I know I'm always going to need to have trees nearby, or I'm not going to be able to produce a lock suit, or I'm not going to be able to do anything different. And it gets that repetitive nature because since you're always relying on tier 1, there's no real sense of growth. It's not like a game like Minecraft where once you've harvested a wooden axe and you cut make a stone axe, you don't need to go back to a wood axe anymore. Your stone axe will do things a lot better. If you do need wood for whatever reason, it's a lot easier and a lot quicker to get. And you get that sense that things are moving along. In Don't Starve, it kind of feels like for every step you go forward, kind of take two steps back. Because while, yes, you build this new item, you waste it or you use up your resources. So now you have to go gather more wood again. And you have to refine that. But now you've ran out of grass, and now you have to get that again. And I think a really good point that you mentioned regarding trying to spice things up. This is one of the things that I would have liked to have seen. Maybe have, like, unique or rarer trees that maybe automatically produce boards, or they produce a lot more logs than before, something to essentially spice up that the routine of having to gather these resources over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. Something that lets you skip past it, but also something that lets you do something different. Like maybe in this game you don't need wood at all because you have something else that does this and has these benefits and these drawbacks, so that the game plays out differently. Just the fact that, you know, even if I was able to move past the need to build wood later in the game, I would still have to, you know, chop down a bunch of trees in the early game every time, and do the same thing. So the problem is twofold, because you have that, and it's, okay, well, now I'm in the late game, and I still need to chop down trees. But even if that were solved, I feel like the root issue would still be there of, okay, well, I'm chopping trees again, because that's what I do at the beginning of every game. You know, there's always going to be a certain amount of that, but it's kind of the same problem that you can have in a strategy game, where if you have the same build order every time, then, you know, what are you doing? Why are you playing? What's the point? You've figured it out, or you've solved the puzzle, whatever it is. And if you don't have to change it up, then there's nothing really new to experience.
And as you said earlier, it becomes less about playing the game and more less about adapting and more about just flexing the same muscle or doing the exact same thing. And as you said, with a strategy game, once you know the perfect build order or the perfect way to play the game, you kind of lose any value of continuing to play, because what else are you going to really learn or change in subsequent games?
I agree completely.
And one other thing about Don't Starve, then, and these complaints that we have about how you can't really change things, you can't really become sustainable, stuff like that, Clay has gone on the record about this in the past, saying that that's sort of how they explicitly designed the game. They want it to be a game where you're never in that sense of stability. Or, like in Minecraft, once you've set up torches around your castle, ever, you're pretty much safe. You've, you know, overcome the darkness. You've reached a point where you can't really be hurt at night. But in Don't Starve, they always want you to have that sense that, oh, you never have enough wood, or your food is always counting down, or you can never get to that point where it's like, eh, I can just, you know, rest here and let the game play out. I don't need to play it anymore.
Yeah. And that's actually exactly what I'm going for in At the Gates as well. But you also have to be changing up what the challenges are. If you have the same challenge over and over and over again, then, you know, again, what is it you're doing? Why even bother? So you want there to be different challenges. You always want there to be different pressures. And maybe the pressure is on the same resource. Maybe you still need wood. Maybe you still need food. But the way you're getting it and the way you're consuming it is different. So maybe in the mid game, you don't need as much food because you have, I don't know, something figured out. But then in late game, you need more, but you have this other way of getting it. So it kind of cycles around, and you're doing different things. But if it's back to, okay, well, you chopped a bunch of trees and then you did this other thing and now you're out of wood, so you have to go chop some trees again. At a certain point, that gets old.
Yeah. And one other part about Don't Starve, I think this will sort of also tie into At the Gates. One thing that I also kind of miss about Don't Starve is that there's no sense of persistence or achievements in the game, in the sense that it's another one of those games where you start with nothing, you're going to end with nothing. You can't carry anything over. There's no reward page or logbook. That's one of the things, actually, incidentally, that I liked about Spelunky, is you have that logbook that's always filling up with all the monsters you find, all the items you discover. Something to give that sense that when I play the game, or if I beat it, that something remains or something is persistent across playthroughs. And this is another one of those decisions that Clay has been adamant on. They said from the start that they didn't want achievements in the game because they felt that when you have those types of achievements that, you know, the ones that make you play a different way, that sort of defeats the purpose of surviving or trying to, you know, overcome this challenge. And on one hand, I can agree with them and I understand that completely. But the other, I kind of miss having that sense that I'm filling up an achievement page or I'm getting something other than just playing through this game, and as we talk about, other than just figuring out the correct build order or the correct pattern and then, you know, moving on to something else.
Yeah, I agree. I'm kind of conflicted on this front, where I personally, as a designer, I don't like achievements, but as a player, I kind of do.
Yeah.
so it's a weird tension there. But I feel like, even, you know, whether or not you have achievements, you still need to address the core issue of, what are you doing each game? What is it? How is it different? And achievements can't replace that, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They can kind of mask it a little bit, but you want to be doing different things. You want to be experiencing new parts of the game. So that's kind of be my focus with At the Gates. I don't think there will be achievements or anything like that, but it's more about, okay, well, in this game, you know, you run into all these things, and then there's a lot of, there are elements of it that you can't address, or that you get kind of a hint of, like, oh, I could have built boats, but I didn't build boats. The next game, I should build boats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the draw of some of these big 4X games like Civ, where you experience something and you're like, oh, next time I want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always enough, okay, next time I want to do this different thing, this new thing,
mm-hmm.
that it keeps you playing, even without the kind of overarching, I'm filling up these buckets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the approach. Either way, it's tough to make it work, but you kind of want to.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my priority, anyways. My big thing is replayability.
Mm-hmm.
And not every game needs to be replayable,
yeah.
But the ones that I really enjoy, that I get into, that I tend to invest my time in, I want to be able to get a lot out of them, because mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of time, and I don't want to play mm-hmm. a bunch of games that might or might not be good. I want one good one that'll keep me there mm-hmm. for a while, and achievements aren't going to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And about that, I would say that the last game that I really just completely sunk my time into was The Binding of Isaac. It's a game where you can pretty much play through a standard run in maybe 20-30 minutes. I think I spent close to 100 hours just going through that game, trying to get all the achievements, unlocking everything, and just getting as much as I could out of it. Because as you said, replayability can really enhance a game, can really make you want to keep playing a game. And more importantly, it adds a lot more value to something that you can only play maybe 10 minutes and then you've seen everything type deal.
Yeah, and achievements can kind of support that and extend the process. So a game like Spelunky, I did spend some time
mm-hmm.
Trying to get the achievement where you beat the game in less than 6 minutes. But if the game wasn't good, I wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah.
So I know that some people do mm-hmm. Tend to favor games that they'd like to collect achievements. But, mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of, I feel like, almost less game design and more
mm-hmm.
psychology in a way. And, you know, I tend to spend my time on other systems, other elements of the game.
Mm-hmm. And as one quick aside then, I just want to get your thought on one thing regarding achievements and value. Regarding the Uplay system, they're the only digital store, the only achievement place that they've actually tied achievements to other things that you use them for. They have what's called U-Points that you can use to get new wallpapers, you maybe unlock a cosmetic item in a game. And the point of it is that you can only get these points by playing the game and completing very specific achievements. So if you beat a game, maybe you'll get 10 U-Points. If you do a crazy, I don't know, achievement, you know, something like Spelunky's beat it in under 7 minutes or 6 minutes type deal, maybe you get another 10 U points. So I'm just wondering, as you said, because achievements, they can sort of mask that sense of replayability, if they were tied to a secondary source or something quantifiable, do you think that would add more value to achievements?
To some extent, yes, but again, it's kind of one of those things that's a little bit dirty.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're preying a little bit more on the psychology mm-hmm. and the need to accumulate and acquire, as opposed to, accomplishing something or achieving something or defeating a challenge of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, those kind of side superfluous things don't really matter to me at all. I know, again, some people do, and that's fine. If you like them, then that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, game development is a zero-sum game. So if you're spending time on those sorts of things, that means less time on game balance or extra characters or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And my preference would be to kind of focus as much time and money on the in-game stuff as possible.
All right, so I think with that, let's move on then to our final topic. And I want to talk a little bit more about At the Gates, and I have just some general strategy game questions for you as well, John.
Sure.
So I guess the first thing then is, since we last spoke a few months ago, what has been happening with At the Gates?
Well, quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Our big focus is, we're kind of wrapping up phase two of mm-hmm. the project. So it kind of used the traditional game development model. There's pre-production, production and then post-production. We got the prototype up pretty early, and that's what we had to show up for the Kickstarter about a year ago. Since then, we've been working on kind of the production stuff, fleshing out the features, adding more art, that sort of thing. And we're getting close to the point where all the really big features are in, and the game will be fully playable. We'll still have some things left, like victory conditions and unique traits for the different factions, but all the big stuff will be in some level. So that includes a lot of things like the economic system I've redone maybe a couple times. I'm in the middle of redoing the map generation. You have different things like the technology system, which are getting in. And then in about a month, maybe a little bit less, we'll be launching our beta. And then from that, we'll have another year and a half of polish time working on the AI, interface, tutorial stuff, balance, all sorts of things. So we still have a long ways to go, but the big stuff is almost out of the way now.
Cool. And I want to talk about one thing. I remember reading a post you wrote, I think maybe a month or so ago, regarding some of the changes you were making to At the Gates. And I think one of the things you said was that you wanted to aim for having to make less choices, but making more important choices with, I guess, I think it was with diplomacy? I don't exactly remember the exact thing you were talking about.
Yeah, it's kind of the philosophy for everything, but a lot of my recent articles and stuff have been related to diplomacy.
Could you talk a little bit more about how the diplomacy model has changed then?
Sure. It's diplomacy is one of the biggest challenges in digital games. And it's primarily because with diplomacy, you're dealing with another agent of, you know, a peer of some sort or close to it. But the problem is computers aren't people. And they never will be. So if you're trying to make a computer simulate a person and how people interact with each other, you're basically doomed.
Yeah.
Because if you think about interacting with another person, you think about, okay, what are they like? What is their mood? What is their personality? You know, what are they thinking about? What do they want? And that kind of shapes your approach and what you think about and what you tell them. Whereas with a computer, you're like, oh, well, it's just numbers. You know, it's math and code and logic and digits and whatever. And, you know, that's all it is. So if an AI does something weird or unexpected, it's because it's a bug or because of the random number generator. Whereas if a person does something weird, it's because they have a weird personality. And there's really no getting past that barrier, I suppose, until we can develop reliable AI that passes the Turing test in academics, then maybe 50 years later, we'll be able to find a way to produce it quickly enough and efficiently enough to make it work in games. But till then, that's kind of not going to work. So all the diplomacy models that aim to make AI players act like humans or behave like humans or seem like humans are kind of doomed to fail. It took me a little while to come to that realization, but I eventually did after doing a lot of brainstorming and playing other games and just trying a couple things out. And what I decided to do was shift over to kind of what I call more of a story approach, where the characters in the game are very clearly not simulating humans. They are kind of like a book or a movie come to life where there are these characters that you believe they have certain motivations and they want certain things. And then they put you on the spot and you're rolled into the story. So somebody might say, you know, this guy intruded on my lands and I need, you know, somebody to call him out. Will you call him out? And you're forced to make these tough decisions that have consequences either way. If you choose to call out the other guy, then that will obviously affect relations with him. And maybe it will affect your global respect or your reputation as well, because people are like, well, he can be pushed around. You know, he doesn't have any honor. He doesn't have any integrity. Or you can say, you know, stuff it, dude. I'm not going to call that guy out. He's my friend or whatever. And then suddenly that guy is upset. Okay. So either way you go, it's going to have an impact on the world. It's going to change the direction that the story is heading. But it's very clearly not, okay, this person or this is a person. This is somebody I'm trying to negotiate with. This is a peer. Instead, it's more like the AI is another system within the game, which is the reality of what it is. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot more going on under the hood, but ultimately what matters is what happens in the player's head. And if you have all these abstract things that are representing a human that they don't see, then that really doesn't matter. But if you're presenting something that it's like, oh, this character did this thing and this character wants this thing, and you're very explicit and very upfront about that, then it becomes like experiencing a story instead of actually talking with another person. And, you know, it's kind of a different approach from what's been tried before. And it's more structured. There's, you know, certain elements to it that are going to be new and unusual, like the fact that, hey, there are these decisions you have to make that are kind of like story points, you know, that are very context-based. They're not just, you know, randomly appeared, or they're not the same every game. And that's the other important part, that you want to feel like the characters know what's going on, that they are part of this world, that they are characters that have motivations and know what's going on, even if they're not actual people. For just like when you're reading a book, for a character to be believable, they have to have believable motivations and react in believable ways to certain situations. And you kind of want to do the same thing in a game, even if the player has a certain amount of control over what's going on. So those are kind of the two big things now, where more of the story approach and making everything very context, very memory-based. Everything connects with everything else. So if somebody asks you to leave their borders, and you do, then they'll remember that. And maybe 100 turns down the road, they'll, you know, do you a favor and be like, hey, that's because you agreed to leave and you're a nice guy. And then they might talk about that 100 turns later when doing something else. And maybe they end up turning on you for some reason. And then they apologize and they say, you know, well, we had all these good times and things happened and, you know, I'm sorry. And, you know, just tying everything together, making it all fit. In a way that really isn't possible with a more open, more this is a human approach. So it's a big shift. Hasn't really been done, like I said, and we'll see how it goes. We have a lot to do still, but a lot of time to do it in.
Yep. And regarding that, that's one thing that I, with a traditional diplomacy model strategy games, that sort of annoy me when it just blatantly shows you, you know, the friendship slider or the relationship meter. That, you know, if it goes, if you're between 50 and 100, they like you. You can do whatever you want to them. But then second draws below 49 to 30, they hate you. They're not going to deal with you. And it becomes very mechanical, very binary in how you approach diplomacy. So with this more like story focus or based on these events, it's not like if you do something really bad to someone, you can't immediately do something good that will sort of offset that, right?
Correct. There will still be numbers as part of the system because, again, you have to make things visible for players. They have to know what's going on. But yeah, if you know certain things, there's no return from. It's they don't counterbalance each other. Every event, every single thing that happens in the game is important. They will remember it, and it will feed into everything else. And building that web is very difficult, and a lot of it comes down to putting constraints on what can happen, because it's easy to be like, oh, you know, we're going to do this system and it's going to be able to do everything and everything can tie into everything. And, you know, they can say everything and they can say this comment mixed with that comment and switch it around in different contexts and different meanings and different moods and things. And it's like, well, if you try to do all that, it's probably not going to work out, because just doing something very simple and localized is already really, really difficult. You know, think about how many strategy games have done diplomacy well, period, at all. So, you know, you kind of want to limit yourself a little bit and make something simple that's good first before trying to make something that's incredibly complex that's good. Nobody's made something that's simple and good, so let's start there first.
And talking about the player having to try to learn this and understand this through a tutorial, that sort of brings me to my next question that I have for you. And this is regarding tutorial design. A few weeks ago, when I spoke with the designer from eRepublic, we got on the discussion regarding the do's and don'ts of trying to help a player understand your game. And I find it very interesting to look at tutorials. They're usually not done very well, or they're done straight that it doesn't really let the player understand things. And the example that I want to bring up is I've been trying to get into AI Wars from Arkane Games for this, like, the fifth or sixth time I've been trying to do it. And while I love Arkane, I've played just about all their games, I enjoyed each one from last year, AI Wars still feels somewhat hard to understand. It's one of those games where you turn on for the first time, you start a new game, and you're presented with four giant tabs full of resources, buildings, tech researchers, the whole deal, and just overwhelms the player. And so my question for you, John, regarding helping someone understand a strategy game, which, as we've talked about, is a series of interconnected systems, what is your approach or your philosophy when it comes to good tutorial design?
That's a good question, and something I've also thought a lot about. It's kind of similar to diplomacy, where I don't think that the typical approach works or is going to get you where you want to be. There are two important things I think to keep in mind with tutorials. One is that people don't like sitting through and clicking things when they're told to click the thing.
Yeah,
people want to play games; they don't want to play tutorials. So you have to keep that in mind, and if you have a tutorial of some kind, you want to shape it in a way that gets away from that. The other important point to remember is that when players are first learning a game, regardless of how smart they are or experienced with whatever genre it is or anything, at least in strategy games especially, they don't know what to do. They don't have the knowledge base to build up a strategy and make interesting, difficult decisions. You just don't yet.
Yeah.
And that happens to me, and I'm a strategy game designer, and I play, you know, Paradox games, and I have no idea what to do, and I play Warlock, and I have no idea what to do, and I play Unit of Command, and I have no idea what to do. And eventually, if the game is good and you play it for a while, you get there. But no matter who you are, what you're good at, how you think, that first game or two or five, you don't know what you're doing. So the tutorial should suggest to you what it thinks you should actually do. And that might be a little bit controversial because, well, you know, hey, isn't the whole point to be making interesting decisions? But you have to ease players in and make them feel comfortable. If they don't feel comfortable with your game, if they feel stressed or if they feel confused or if they feel like the game is too hard or doesn't explain things, then they're just going to stop playing. And you don't want that. So if you have the ability to make whatever decisions you want to make, if you have that flexibility, it's not a guided tutorial, it's not a tour, but the game is saying, hey, you know, you should probably build another settler right now because your population is getting big and there's another resource over there you could grab. It's like, oh, okay, I'll build a settler. And then, you know, it's like, hey, you're running out of money, you should build this thing to produce more money. And you're like, well, I don't really need to do that because I'm going to get money this other way. You can ignore the advice. You don't have to obey it, but it helps provide a safety net in a sense to carry players along when they don't know what the strategy is yet. So that's kind of the two-pronged approach for me. There's not going to be a fixed tutorial. Click this button. Now move this guy here on this fixed map. And now, you know, move your camera over here. This is how you move the camera. You know, I'm not going to have that, and it's also going to be context-based. So if you're not going to have a fixed tutorial, you need a tutorial system that can figure out what's going on. Again, it's not simple. It's going to be tough. It's not something that people really like to do as developers. It's not sexy. It's not fun. Yeah. But it makes a big difference. So I've taken a pretty different approach with At the Gates, but I think it's going to pay off. It helps that I do like interface. I do like spending the time on these things and making the game more polished and easier to learn and understand. Because I know a lot of developers don't like that sort of thing. They like the guts, or they like working on, you know, the math stuff or the art or whatever. And doing the interface and the tutorial is kind of the, you know, last thing on the list. But it's important, and I like doing it. So hopefully those two things come together and it pays off.
Yeah. Now, regarding tutorials, one thing that I found interesting that I talked about before is how I've been sort of turning to Let's Plays in an attempt to try to learn these games, especially when I was trying to learn Crusader Kings 2. And I think one element that Let's Plays sort of work better than a traditional tutorial is that they teach the player in a sense of how you're playing the game, as opposed to, as you were just saying, having all these different systems in a vacuum, you know, saying, click here, raise your economy. Okay, now go here and move this unit. With a Let's Play, you're generally learning the game in the order that you would traditionally play the game. And I think that sort of helps reinforces what you're trying to teach the player as to how the game works and how these systems interact with each other.
Yeah, yeah. It's tricky because everybody learns in different ways. Yeah. So you can't just say, all right, well, this is the solution. This is the tutorial that will work. Or this, you know, we will just have videos and everybody will watch those and it'll be great. Or we'll have a manual and everybody will read those and it'll be great. Because no one approach is going to work. So the videos can be very, very valuable. My issue with them is that there's only going to be a small percentage of people who ever see them, regardless of how popular they are, how popular or not your game is. The advantage a built-in tutorial can have is that it's there for everybody always. And if you have a specific tutorial option, not everybody will click on that. But if it's an integrated tutorial that is context-aware and you know, integrated with what's going on, like I was talking about, then that can be a useful tool available to everybody. And, you know, not 100% of people will enjoy it or learn the game effectively from that. Some people will prefer other methods, but I feel like it's the best option available. And other ones can supplement that, like videos. But it ultimately, with games, you're kind of playing the percentages. And it's kind of like multiplayer, even in the most multiplayer heavy games that aren't, you know, required multiplayer, like MMOs, the percentage of people that play multiplayer is pretty low. I forget what exact numbers are, but I remember something with like StarCraft or whatever. It was like 25% of people play multiplayer, 75% play single player, which just sounds astonishing. Yeah. But, you know, people are used to the model where they plug in the game, they play it, and then they don't really interact with anything else related to it. And you have to account for that as a developer.
And I think another disadvantage regarding videos is the fact they are pretty much a passive learning experience. You're just sitting there watching someone talk about the game as opposed to, as you said, playing the game and having this context guide sort of guide you towards what you should be learning, what you should be focusing on at any given moment.
Yeah, and like I said, it comes down to everybody having a different way of learning. And videos are really effective for some people. For me, they don't really work because they just don't seem time efficient. And, you know, maybe a tutorial isn't either, but that just means I'm inclined to not play a game or it's a tutorial at all. Yeah. Instead of, you know, finding the one that takes the least amount of time, I'm just not going to do it unless it's done well somehow in a way that appeals to me. And a lot of people are the same way. It's easy to give up on a game. People don't have an obligation to play it and enjoy it. So as a developer, you really have to go out of your way and try to accommodate that. That's your job. That's what people are paying for, and that's what people want.
Yep, and that sort of goes back to our earlier discussion regarding price. When you had dozens of games being released for like $5, $3, whatever, you have less of a requirement to spend a lot of time in these games because you only spend $3 on it. If a game pisses you off or you get tired of it, it's not like you have nothing else to play. You've got, I mean, hell, I've got probably 40, 50 games in my backlog that I've never touched or I may never even get to play at this rate.
Yep, and everybody's different. Yep. Even there's a lot of people where money isn't even an issue. They'll buy a game they want to play, and it doesn't matter how much it costs or what it does or doesn't do or what multiplayer support it does or doesn't have or anything else. And money is certainly a factor for some people, but even then, I feel like you know, people will play what they want to play and don't play what they don't want to play, and how much they spent on it a lot of times doesn't matter.
Yeah.
For better and worse.
All right. I think this is the last question I have for you, John, and it's one that I really wanted to ask you regarding strategy design. You mentioned a few minutes ago that you like doing the UI, you like sort of figuring out how these systems will work. So my question for you then is regarding UI design, namely in the sense of, in your opinion, what's your philosophy regarding how much information to throw at a player? We've talked about this before in other casts, where in some strategy games, you load it up and you're just hit with, you know, screens and screens of stats, data, all kinds of stuff that just assault the player. And then there's other strategy games where all that information is just hidden underneath layers and layers of other UIs, other menus to, you know, try to figure out, oh, my tax rate's actually going down. So for you, where does your opinion lie on what's a good balance to strike between giving the player just enough information to understand what's going on?
Ideally, your interface grows as players play. Mm-hmm. So at the start of the game, there might be, for example, a government button that just doesn't show up because you can't change your government and there's nothing to do there and it doesn't do anything yet. So you can effectively hide that. Mm-hmm. You also want an option to turn all the stuff on because somebody might just install the game on a new computer and want to just be like, hey, give me all the buttons. Mm-hmm. I want them. But ideally at the beginning, you can pare things down to the absolute minimum and give players the option to turn them on or make them available when they matter. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of notification system. I've noticed something very Civ 5 like has appeared in quite a few games since, which I'm pretty proud of. It's cool to see the kind of standard take hold because it is a really good way of parsing information. It's like, hey, there's this important thing. This is the thing you need to deal with. And you can kind of be paying attention to that corner. You can let that corner drive the experience a little bit when you don't really know what's going on yet. So if you have units that still need moving in Civ 5 and at the gates as well, I have it so that the end turn button changes into a button that says, like, units need orders. And if you click it, it'll cycle you through the units that need orders. Mm-hmm. And then when they all have orders, it switches to the end turn button. So you can always kind of be concentrating on this corner, even if there's a lot of other stuff on the screen, which ideally there's not, but sometimes there's no way around it. Some games are more complex. At the gates is more complex than a platformer. There's going to be more UI in the screen no matter what. That's just the way it is. But having conventions like that where you can focus on certain things is really beneficial. It teaches players that they can kind of focus on this one thing, even if they don't understand other parts of the game or other parts of the interface, and that at least drives them along and keeps them moving, keeps them engaged, keeps the game going instead of things just kind of grinding to a halt, because a lot of games don't do that, and you get to a certain point, it's like, what do I do?
Yeah.
What should I care about at all? Like, what is the priority right now? I don't even know what the number one thing is that I should be focusing on, and there might be something really important happening. And,
yeah, you know, who knows what's happening.
Yeah, it's kind of like the tutorial stuff again, where it's not particularly fun to work on for most developers, so they generally don't, and it shows. But fortunately, I actually have a decent interest in it, so I spend quite a bit of time figuring out what actually works and iterating on it and testing it and making more changes and not, you know, saving it until the last moment. So At the Gate still has quite a ways to go, but the interface is, you know, roughly on par with something like Civ 5 already. And we're looking at adding a lot more to it just because, again, it's important and something I like doing, and hopefully we can keep making it even better.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I know, while the strategy games I play, I always had that, you know, deer in the headlights moment while I'm trying to learn these games. I had it when I was trying to learn Planetary Annihilation, especially with Crusader Kings 2, as we talked about, when you just lay everything out there for the player without giving them any guidance as to, okay, maybe you should build your province first, or maybe you should look at your treasury first. When you just say, okay, here's everything, the player has no idea how to connect the dots, in a manner of speaking, of what to prioritize first or what needs their immediate attention.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, you know?
So I think with that, we can start wrapping things up. I know our last chat, I think we talked for like almost 3 hours, which was great on one hand, but then I think we were both pretty much tired at the end of that.
Yeah, it's getting to that point where it's like, all right, starting to get hungry.
Yeah.
Need to replenish the fuel stock.
Yep. This time I was smart enough to have dinner beforehand instead of waiting after. So I'm one step ahead this time.
Yeah, never works for me. I've done dozens, hundreds of podcasts now, and I always end up eating after, and I always regret it.
Yeah. All right, so before we say our goodbye then, do you have any final topics or anything you just want to bring up before we end things?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, anybody that checks out At the Gates or even pre-orders it, especially, very much appreciated. As we've talked about on this podcast. We're trying to do a lot of interesting, innovative things with the game, not just with the gameplay, but interface and tutorial, and trying to focus on what matters and spending the time to do it right. And it's certainly not easy, but it's a lot of fun. So I can't complain, but yeah, I'm hoping and expecting that it does well, and we'll be able to make other similar style games or games that are kind of pushing the envelope in similar ways. So excited to get the game out there at some point, you know, in 2015, and then hopefully be making some other cool projects. So anybody that checks it out, you can go to our website, which is atthegatesgame.com. You can also go to my personal website where I do writing and whatnot, johnshaferondesign.com. It's J-O-N-S-H-A-F-E-R. Or you can follow me on Twitter at johnshaferdesign. I tweet about various things, sometimes related to At the Gates, sometimes related to the industry, sometimes related to programming, sometimes related to the weather, you know, usual Twitter stuff. So, you know, give me a follow and say hi. I'm always happy to chat with anybody if you have any questions or want to talk about game design or At the Gates or anything else. So, yeah, I think that's about it.
Awesome. Yeah, and as I said on the last cast, I'm also really looking forward to At the Gates. As we talked about between last time and this time, I really want to see a turn-based strategy game that's done a little bit differently, or one that sort of avoids a lot of the missteps and issues we've seen with traditional strategy game development. As we talked about, a lot of it in tutorial and the general lack of replayability in terms of design in a lot of strategy games.
Strategy games are tough.
Yeah.
they are really tough. And even if you spend the time, you need the skill set. And even if you have the skill set, you need to spend the time. And even if both align, it's still really hard and you make a lot of mistakes. And it takes a lot of time to polish and add everything. And everything has to fit together just so. It's not like a platformer where, you know, if one particular level is bad, that's okay because the rest of the game is great. If one particular feature of a strategy game doesn't work, then the whole rest of the game comes falling in on it. But big, difficult projects are kind of what I do. You know, it's it's like the Spelunky of work, or maybe vice versa. I don't even know. But it's what I love to do. So we'll be in this corner of the business making these types of games forever, at least as long as there's still money in it. So I'm pretty excited to get it out there as well, but it's one of those things. It takes a while, so appreciate everybody's patience, but should be worth it once we finally get to that point.
Awesome. So I think with that, we can wrap things up. And I know that we didn't spend a lot of time talking about At the Gates. So for those of you who have just caught this podcast and want to know a lot of what we talked about in the original podcast, I'll post a link to that, as well as links to John's site and At the Gates in the podcast notes below. So, with that said, John, again, it was a pleasure talking to you. Good that you survived your GDC trip.
Absolutely, yeah. It was looking a little dicey there, but made it back and back to programming. So all clear on that. But yeah, thanks, Josh, for having me on. It was a pleasure. I always love chatting about games and design and what I'm up to. So hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Yep, definitely. If you're not you know, completely swamping programming in the next few months, I would love to have you back on.
Excellent. Well, we'll see. There's a lot of programming to do, but hopefully enough to, or not so much that I can't get away for a couple of hours. But thanks again, Josh.
Yep, not a problem. With that said, we're going to end things for this week's podcast. As always, for those of you listening, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, either by writing a guest piece for the site or by appearing on a future podcast, you can send me an email through Submissions Wanted on the front page. That will take you to all the email address, guidelines, and just general information. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.